It sounded like a string quartet. "The party," said Dor. Right, the people in the dinner jackets they had queued up with. No, the Angelus didn't seem to be here either. Dor walked into the next hall along, and Richard trailed in her wake. He wished he could be of more use. "This Angelus," he said, "what does it look like?" For a moment he thought she was going to reprimand him simply for asking. But she stopped, rubbed her forehead. "This just says it's got a picture of an angel on it. But it can't be that hard to find. After all," she added hopefully, "how many things with angels on them are there here?" Chapter 9. Jessica was under a little pressure. She was worried and nervous and jittery. She had catalogued the collection, arranged with the British Museum to host the exhibition, organised the restoration of the prime exhibit, assisted in hanging and exhibiting the collection, and had put together the list of invitees to the fabulous launch. It was just as well she didn't have a boyfriend, she would tell her friends. There'd be no time for one even if she had one. Still, it would be nice, she thought, when she got a moment. Someone to go to galleries with on the weekends. Someone to... No. She did not go to that place in her head. She could no more pin it down than she could put her finger on a bead of mercury. And she refocused on the exhibition. Even now, at the last minute, there were so many things that could go wrong. Many a horse had fallen at the final hurdle. Many an overconfident general had seen certain victory turn to defeat in the closing minutes of a battle. Jessica was simply going to ensure that nothing went wrong. She was wearing a green silk dress, an off-the-shoulder general marshalling her troops, and stoically pretending that Mr. Stockton was not half an hour late. Her troops consisted of a head waiter, a dozen serving staff, three women from the caterers, a string quartet, and her assistant, a young man named Clarence. Jessica was convinced that Clarence had only got his job because he was A, openly gay, and B, just as openly black. And thus it was a source of general irritation to her that he was by far the most efficient, competent, and best assistant she had had to date. She inspected the drinks table. "We're fine for champagne, yes?" The head waiter pointed to the crate of champagne beneath the table. "And sparkling mineral water?" Another nod. Another crate. Jessica pursed her lips. "What about still mineral water? Bubbles aren't everybody's cup of tea, you know." They had plenty of still mineral water. Good. The string quartet were warming up. They were not quite loud enough to drown the noise coming from the hallway outside. It was the noise of a small but affluent crowd. The grumbling of ladies in mink coats, and men who, were it not for the no-smoking signs on the walls, and perhaps the advice of their doctors, would be smoking cigars. The grumbling of journalists and celebrities who could smell the canapés, vol-au-vents, sundry nibbles, and free champagne. Clarence was talking to someone on his mobile phone, a slimline piece of fold-out engineering that made the Star Trek communicators look bulky and old-fashioned. He turned it off, put it into the Armani pocket of his Armani suit without disturbing the line. He smiled, reassuringly. Jessica, Mr. Stockton's driver's phoned from the car. They're still running a couple of minutes late. Nothing to worry about. Nothing to worry about, echoed Jessica. Doomed. Doomed! The whole thing was going to be a disaster. Her disaster. She picked up a glass of champagne from the table, emptied it, and handed the empty glass to the wine waiter. Clarence tipped his head on one side, listening to the grumbling reverberation from the hallway outside. He looked at his watch, then looked at Jessica questioningly, a captain querying his general. "Into the Valley of Death, then, boss?" "Mr. Stockton is on his way, Clarence," she said calmly. "He has requested a private viewing before the event begins." "Shall I go out and see how they're doing?" "No," said Jessica decisively. Then, just as decisively, "Yes." Food and drink dealt with, Jessica turned to the string quartet and asked them, for the third time that evening, exactly what they planned to play. Clarence opened the double doors. It was worse than he had thought. There had to be more than 100 people in the hall, and they weren't just people. They were people. Some of them were even personalities. "Excuse me," said the chairman of the Arts Council. "The invitation said 8 o'clock sharp. It's 8:20 already." "We'll just be a few more minutes," reassured Clarence smoothly. "Security arrangements." A woman in a hat bore down on him. Her voice was stentorian, bullying, and decidedly parliamentary. "Young man," she announced, "do you know who I am?"
Not really, no," lied Clarence, who knew exactly who all of them were.
Hang on a sec, I'll see if anyone in here does." He shut the door behind him. "Jessica, they're going to riot." "Don't exaggerate, Clarence." She was moving around the room like a green silk whirlwind, positioning her serving staff with their trays of canapes or drinks in strategic corners of the hall, checking the public address system, the podium, the curtain, and the pull rope. "I can see the headlines now," said Clarence, unfolding an imaginary newspaper. "Geritol billionaires crush marketing babe in museum canapé dash horror." Somebody began knocking at the door. The volume in the hallway began to increase. Somebody was saying very loudly, Excuse me. Someone else was informing the world that it was a disgrace. Quite simply, a disgrace. No other word for it.
"Executive decision," said Clarence suddenly. "I'm letting them in."
Jessica shouted, "No, if you..." But it was too late. The doors were open and the horde was pushing its way into the hall. The expression on Jessica's face morphed from one of horror to one of charmed delight. She shimmered toward the door. "Baroness," she said, with a happy smile, "I can't tell you how delighted we are that you were able to come to our little exhibition this evening. Mr. Stockton's been unavoidably delayed, but he'll be here momentarily. Please have some canapés." Over the Baroness's mink-draped shoulder, Clarence winked at her cheerfully. Jessica ran through all the bad words she knew in her head. As soon as the Baroness had headed for the vol-au-vents, Jessica walked over to Clarence and, in a whisper and still smiling, called him several of them. Richard froze. A security guard was coming straight toward them, the beam of his flashlight flashing from side to side. He looked around for somewhere to hide. Too late. Another guard was coming toward them, past the huge statues of dead Greek gods, flashlight beam swinging.
"All right,"
called the first guard. The other guard kept coming toward Richard and Dor and stopped just beside them.
"I suppose," she said, "I've already had to stop a couple of tosspots in suits from carving their initials on the Rosetta Stone. I hate these functions."
The first guard shone his flashlight straight into Richard's eyes, then let the beam slide off, skittering over shadows.
"I keep telling you," he said with the satisfied relish of any true prophet, "it's the mask of the Red Death all over again. A decadent elite party while civilization crumbles about their ears."
He picked his nose, wiped it on the leather sole of his well-polished black boot. The second guard sighed.
"Thank you, Gerald. Right, back on patrol."
The guards walked out of the hall together. "Last one of these things we found someone had puked in a sarcophagus," said one of the guards. And then the door closed behind them.
"If you're part of London below,"
said Dor to Richard in a conversational voice as they walked side by side into the next hall,
"they normally don't even notice you exist,
unless you stop and talk to them. And even then they forget you pretty quickly.
But I saw you,
said Richard. It had been bothering him for a while.
I know, said Dor. Isn't that odd?
Everything's odd, said Richard, with feeling. The string music was getting louder. The surges of anxiety were somehow worse up here in London above, where he was forced to reconcile these two universes. At least below he could proceed dreamlike, putting one foot in front of the other, like a sleepwalker. The Angelus is through there, announced Dor, interrupting his reverie and pointing to the direction from which the music was coming.
How do you know?
I know, she said with utter certainty.
Come on.
They stepped out of the darkness into a lighted corridor. There was a huge sign hanging across the corridor. It said, Angels Over England, an exhibition at the British Museum, sponsored by Stockton's PLC. They crossed the corridor and walked through an open door into a large room in which a party was going on. There was a string quartet playing, and a number of serving staff were providing a room full of well-dressed people with food and drink. There was a small stage in one corner of the room, with a podium on it beside a high curtain. The room was completely filled with angels. There were statues of angels on tiny plinths. There were paintings of angels on the walls. There were angel frescoes. There were huge angels and tiny angels, stiff angels and amiable angels, angels with wings and halos and angels with neither, warlike angels and peaceable angels. There were modern angels and classical angels, hundreds upon hundreds of angels of every size and shape, Western angels, Middle Eastern angels, Eastern angels, Michelangelo angels, Joel Peter Witkin angels, Picasso angels, Warhol angels. Mr. Stockton's angel collection was, in the words of the Time Out review, indiscriminate to the point of trashiness, but certainly impressive in its eclecticism.
Would you think, Richard asked, that I was being picky if I pointed out that trying to find something with an angel on it in here is going to be like trying to find a needle in an Oh My God, It's Jessica?
Richard felt the blood drain from his face. Until now, he had thought that that was simply a figure of speech. He hadn't thought it actually happened in real life.
Someone you knew?
Asked Dor. Richard nodded.
She was my... Well, we were going to be married. We've been together for a couple of years. She was with me when I found you. She was the one on the... She left that message on the answering machine.
He pointed across the room. Jessica was making animated conversation with Lord Lloyd Webber, Sir Bob Geldof, and a bespectacled gentleman whom she strongly suspected of being a Saatchi. Every few minutes, she checked her watch and glanced toward the door.
Her?
Said Dor, remembering the woman, then obviously feeling that she should say something nice about someone Richard had cared for, she said,
Well, she's very...
And she paused and thought, and then said,
Clean.
Richard stared across the room.
Well, she... Is she going to be upset that we're here?
I doubt it, said Dor.
Frankly, unless you do something stupid, like talk to her, she probably won't even notice you.
And then, with more enthusiasm, she said, Food! She descended on the canapes like a small, smut-nosed, pixie-faced, red-haired, big brown leather-jacketed girl who hadn't eaten properly in ages. Enormous quantities of food were immediately crammed into her mouth, masticated and swallowed, while at the same time the more substantial sandwiches were wrapped in paper napkins and placed into her pockets. Then, with a paper plate heaped high with chicken legs, melon slices, mushroom vol-au-vents, caviar puffs and small venison sausages, she began to circle the room, staring intently at each and every angelic artifact. Richard trailed along behind her with a brie and fennel sandwich and a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice. Jessica was deeply puzzled. She had noticed Richard, and having noticed him, she had noticed Dore. There was something familiar about them both. It was like a tickle at the back of her head, impossible to place, utterly irritating. It reminded Jessica of something her mother had once told her about, of how Jessica's mother had, one evening, encountered a woman she had known all her life, had been to school with, had served on the parish council with, had run the coconut shy at the village fete with, and how her mother, encountering the woman at a party, had suddenly realized that she was unable to recall the woman's name, although she knew the woman had a husband in publishing named Eric and a golden retriever named Major. It had left Jessica's mother quite disgruntled. It was driving Jessica to distraction. "Who are those people?" she asked Clarence. "Them? Well, he's the new editor of Vogue. She's the arts correspondent of the New York Times. The one between them is Kate Moss, I think." "No, not them," said Jessica. "Them! There." Clarence looked in the place that she was pointing. "Hmm? Oh, them." He couldn't understand how he had failed to see them before. Old age, he thought. He would soon be 23. "Journalists?" he said, without much conviction. "Well, they do look rather trendoid. Grunge chic, please. I know I invited the face." "I know him," said Jessica, frustrated. Then Mr. Stockton's chauffeur phoned from Holborn to say that he was almost at the British Museum, and Richard slid out of her head like mercury trickling through her fingers. "See anything?" asked Richard. Dore shook her head and swallowed a mouthful of hastily chewed chicken leg. "It's like playing Spot the Pigeon in Trafalgar Square," she said. "There's nothing that feels like the Angelus. The paper said I'd know it if I saw it." And she wandered off, inspecting angels, pushing her way past a captain of industry, the deputy leader of the opposition, and the highest-paid call girl in the south of England. Richard turned away and found himself face to face with Jessica. Her hair was piled on her head, and it framed her face perfectly in corkscrews of chestnut curls. She was very beautiful. She was smiling at him. It was the smile that did it. "Hello, Jessica," he said. "How are you?"
"Hello. You won't believe this," she said, "but my assistant failed to make a note of your newspaper, Mr. R."
"Paper," said Richard.
"Did I say newspaper?"
said Jessica with a tinkling, sweet and self-deprecating laugh.
"Magazine, television station. You are with the media."
"You're looking very fine, Jessica," said Richard.
"You have the advantage of me," she said, smiling roguishly.
"You're Jessica Bartram. You're a marketing executive at Stockton's. You're 26. Your birthday is April the 23rd, and in the throes of extreme passion, you have a tendency to hum the monkey's song, I'm a Believer." Jessica was no longer smiling.
"Is this some kind of joke?" she asked, coldly.
"Oh, and we've been engaged for the last 18 months, said Richard. Jessica smiled nervously. Perhaps this really was some kind of joke. One of those jokes that everyone else seemed to get, and she never did.
"I rather think I'd know if I'd been engaged to someone for 18 months, Mr.
Said Jessica.
"Mayhew,"
said Richard helpfully. "Richard Mayhew, you chucked me, and I don't exist anymore." Jessica waved urgently at no one in particular all the way across the room.
"I'll be right there,"
she called desperately. and she began to back away.
"I'm a believer," sang Richard cheerfully. "I couldn't leave her if I tried."
Jessica snatched a glass of champagne from a passing tray, downed it in a gulp. At the far end of the room, she could see Mr. Stockton's chauffeur, and where Mr. Stockton's chauffeur was. She headed toward the doors.
"So, who was he?"
asked Clarence, edging alongside her.
"Who?"
"Your mystery man."
"I don't know," she admitted.
Then she said, "Look, maybe you ought to call security."
"Okay. Why?"
Just get me security." And then Mr. Arnold Stockton entered the hall, and everything else went out of her head.
Expansive, he was, and expensive. A Hogarth cartoon of a man, enormous of girth, many-chinned and broad-stomached.
He was over 60. His hair was grey and silver, and it was cut too long in the back because it made people uncomfortable that his hair was too long, and Mr. Stockton liked making people uncomfortable. Compared to Arnold Stockton, Rupert Murdoch was a shady little piker, and the late Robert Maxwell was a beached whale. Arnold Stockton was a pit bull, which was how caricaturists often chose to draw him. Stockton's owned a little bit of everything. Satellites, newspapers, record companies, amusement parks, books, magazines, comics, television stations, film companies.
"I'll make the speech now," said Mr. Stockton to Jessica, by way of introduction. "Then I'll bugger off. Come back some other time when there aren't all these stuffed shirts about."
"Right," said Jessica. "Yes, the speech now. Of course." And she led him up onto the little stage, up to the podium. She tinked her fingernail against a glass for silence. Nobody heard her, so she said,
"Excuse me,"
into the microphone. This time the conversation quieted.
"Ladies and gentlemen, honoured guests, I'd like to welcome all of you to the British Museum," she said, "to the Stockton-sponsored exhibition Angels Over England, and to the man behind it all, our Chief Executive and Chairman of the Board, Mr. Arnold Stockton."
The guests applauded, none of them in any doubt as to who had assembled the collection of angels, nor for that matter, who paid for their champagne. Mr. Stockton cleared his throat.
"Right," he said, "this won't take long. When I was a small boy, I used to come to the British Museum on Saturdays, because it was free, and we didn't have much money. But I'd come up the big steps to the museum, and I'd come down to this room round the back, and look up at this angel. It was like it knew what I was thinking."
Just at that moment, Clarence came back in, a couple of security guards beside him. He pointed to Richard, who had stopped to listen to Mr. Stockton's speech. Dorr was still examining exhibits. "No, him," Clarence kept saying to the guards in an undertone. "No, a look, just there. Yes, him."
"Anyway, like anything that's not looked after," continued Mr. Stockton, "it decayed, fell apart under the stresses and strains of modern times, went rotten, went bad. Well, it's taken a shitload of money."
He paused to let it sink in. If he, Arnold Stockton, thought it was a shitload, then a shitload it certainly was.
"And a dozen craftsmen have spent a great deal of time restoring it and fixing it up. After this, the exhibition will be going to America and then around the world. So maybe it can inspire some other little penniless bugger to start his own communications empire."
He turned around, turned to Jessica, muttered,
"What do I do now?"
She pointed to the pull rope at the side of the curtain. Mr. Stockton pulled the rope. The curtain billowed and opened, revealing an old door behind it. Again, there was a small flurry of activity in Clarence's corner of the room.
"No, him," said Clarence. "For heaven's sake, are you blind?"
It looked like it had once been the door to a cathedral. It was the height of two men, and wide enough for a pony to walk through. Carved into the wood of the door and painted with red and white and gold leaf was an extraordinary angel. It stared out at the world with blank medieval eyes. There was an impressed gasp from the guests. Then they began to applaud. "The Angelus!" Dor tugged at Richard's sleeve. "That's it! Richard, come on!" She ran for the stage.
"Excuse me, sir," said a guard to Richard.
"Might we see your invitation?"
said another, taking Richard firmly but discreetly by the arm. "And do you have any identification?"
No, said Richard.
Dor was up on the stage. Richard tried to yank free and follow her, hoping that the guards would forget about him. They didn't. Now that he had been brought to their attention, they were going to proceed to treat him as they might any other shabby, unwashed, somewhat unshaven gatecrasher. The guard who was holding Richard increased his grip on his arm, muttering, "None of that." Dor paused on the stage, wondering how to make the guards let Richard go. Then she did the only thing she could think of. She went over to the microphone, went up on tiptoes, and she screamed as loud as she possibly could into the public address system. She had a remarkable scream. It could, with no artificial assistance, go through your head like a new power drill with a bone saw attachment. And amplified, it was simply unearthly. A waitress dropped her tray of drinks. Heads turned, hands covered ears. All conversation stopped. People stared at the stage in puzzlement and horror, and Richard made a break for it.
"Sorry,"
he said to the stunned guard, as he yanked his arm out of the man's grip and fled.
"Wrong London."
He reached the stage, grabbed Dor's outstretched left hand. Her right hand touched the Angelus, the enormous cathedral door. Touched it, and opened it. This time, no one dropped any drinks. They were frozen, staring, utterly overwhelmed, and momentarily blinded. The Angelus had opened, and light from behind the door had flooded the room with radiance. People covered their eyes, then hesitantly opened them again, and simply stared. It was as if fireworks had been let off in the room, not indoor fireworks, strange crawling things that sputter and smell bad, nor even the kind of fireworks that you let off in your back garden, but the kind of industrial-strength fireworks that get fired up high enough to cause a potential menace to the airways, the kind of fireworks that end the day at Walt Disney World or that give the fire marshals headaches at Pink Floyd concerts. It was a moment of pure magic. The audience stared, entranced and amazed. The only noise to be heard was the gentle, gasping, almost groan of wonderment people make when they watch fireworks, the sound of awe. Then a grubby young man and a smut-faced girl in a huge leather jacket walked into the light show and vanished. The door closed behind them. The light show was over. And everything was normal again. The guests and guards and serving staff blinked, shook their respective heads, and having dealt with something entirely outside of their experience, agreed, somehow without a word, that it had simply never happened. The string quartet began to play once more. Mr. Stockton walked off, nodding brusquely to various acquaintances as he did so. Jessica walked over to Clarence.
"What?" she asked quietly, "are those security guards doing in here?"
The guards in question were standing amongst the guests, looking around as if they were themselves unsure what they were doing there. Clarence began to explain just what the guards were doing there, and then he realized that he had absolutely no idea.
"I'll deal with it," said Clarence, efficiently.
Jessica nodded. She looked out over her party and smiled benignly. It was all going rather well. Richard and Dor walked into the light. And then it was dark and chill, and Richard was blinking at the retinal after-image of the light, which left him almost blinded. A ghostly series of orange-green splotches that slowly faded as his eyes accustomed themselves to the darkness that surrounded them. They were in a huge hall, carved from rock. Iron pillars, black and rust-dusted, held up the roof, went off into the distant dark, perhaps for miles. From somewhere he could hear the gentle splash of water. A fountain, perhaps, or a spring. Dor was still holding his hand, tightly. In the distance, a tiny flame flickered and flared, and another, and then another. It was a host of candles flickering into flame, Richard realized. And walking toward them through the candles was a tall figure dressed in a simple white robe. The figure seemed to be moving slowly, but it must have been walking very fast, as it was only seconds before it was standing beside them. It had golden hair and a pale face. It was not much taller than Richard, but it made him feel like a little child. It was not a man. It was not a woman. It was very beautiful. Its voice was quiet. It said, "The Lady Dor, yes?" Dor said, "Yes." A gentle smile. It nodded its head to her, almost humbly. "It is an honor, finally, to meet you and your companion. I am the angel Islington." Its eyes were clear and wide. Its robes were not white, as Richard had initially thought. They seemed to have been woven from a light. Richard did not believe in angels. He had never believed in angels. He was damned if he was going to start now. Still, it was much easier not to believe in something when it's not actually looking directly at you and saying your name. "Richard Mayhew," it said. "You, too, are welcome here, in my halls." It turned away. "Please," it said, "follow me." Richard and Dor followed the angel through the caverns. The candles extinguished themselves behind them. The Marquis de Carabas strode through the empty hospital, broken glass and old syringes crunching beneath his square-toed black motorcycle boots. He stepped through a double door that led into a back staircase. He went down the stairs to the cellars beneath the hospital. He walked through the rooms beneath the building, stepping fastidiously around the heaps of mouldering rubbish. He walked through the showers and the toilets, down an old iron staircase through a wet, swampy place, and then he pulled open a half-rotted wooden door and went inside. He looked around the room in which he found himself. He inspected, with magnificent disdain, the half-eaten kitten and the heap of razor blades. Then he cleared the debris off a chair and sat down comfortably, luxuriantly, in the dankness of the cellar, and he closed his eyes. Eventually, the door to the cellar was opened, and people came in. And the Marquis de Carabas opened his eyes and yawned. Then he flashed Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar a huge smile. "Hello, boys," said de Carabas. "I thought it high time I came down here to talk to you, in person." Chapter 10. "Do you drink wine?" it asked. Richard nodded. "I had a little wine once," said Dor, hesitantly. "My father, he, at dinner, would let us taste it." The angel Islington lifted the bottle. It looked like some kind of decanter. Richard wondered if the bottle was made of glass. It refracted and reflected the candlelight so strangely. Perhaps it was some kind of crystal, or one huge diamond. It even made it seem that the wine inside was glowing, as if it were made of light. The angel took the top off the crystal and poured an inch of the liquid inside it into a wine glass. It was a white wine, but a wine unlike any Richard had ever seen. and threw light around the caverns like sunlight on a swimming pool. Dora and Richard sat around an age-blackened wooden table on huge wooden chairs and said nothing.
"This wine," said Islington, "is the last bottle of its kind. I was given a dozen bottles by one of your ancestors."
It handed the glass to Dora and began to pour another inch of the glowing wine from the decanter into another glass. It did this reverently, almost lovingly, like a priest performing a ritual. It was a welcome gift. This was, 30,000, 40,000 years ago, quite a while ago, at any rate. It passed the wine glass to Richard.
"I suppose that you could accuse me of squandering something I should treasure," it told them. "But I receive guests so rarely, and the way here is hard."
"The Angelus," murmured Dor.
"You travelled here using the Angelus, yes. But that way only works once for each traveller."
The angel raised its glass high, staring at the light.
"Drink it carefully," it advised them. "It is most potent."
It sat down at the table between Richard and Dor.
"When one tastes it," it said wistfully, "I like to imagine that one is actually tasting the sunlight of bygone days."
It held up its glass.
"A toast to former glories."
"Former glories," chorused Richard and Dor. And then, a little warily, they tasted the wine, sipping it, not drinking.
"It's amazing," said Dor.
"It really is," said Richard. "I thought old wines turned to vinegar when they were exposed to air."
The angel shook its head.
"Not this one. It is all a matter of the type of grape and the place it was grown. This kind of grape, alas, perished when the vineyard vanished beneath the waves."
"It's magical," said Dor, sipping the liquid light.
"I've never tasted anything like it."
"And you never will again," said Islington. "There is no more wine from Atlantis." Somewhere inside Richard, a small, reasonable voice pointed out that there never was an Atlantis, and thus emboldened, went on to state that there were no such things as angels, and that, for that matter, most of his experiences of the last few days had been impossible. Richard ignored it. He was learning, awkwardly, to trust his instincts and to realize that the simplest and most likely explanations for what he had seen and experienced recently were the ones that had been offered to him, no matter how unlikely they might seem. He opened his mouth and tasted the wine once more. It made him feel happy. It made him think of skies bigger and bluer than any he had ever seen, a golden sun hanging huge in the sky, everything simpler, everything younger than the world he knew. There was a waterfall to the left of them. Clear water ran down the rock and collected in the rock pool. To the right of them was a door set between two iron pillars. The door was made of polished flint set in a metal that was almost black in colour.
"You really claim to be an angel?" Richard asked. "I mean, you've actually met God and everything."
Islington smiled tolerantly.
"I claim nothing, Richard," it said. "But I am an angel."
"You honour us," said Dor.
"No. You do me much honour by coming here. Your father was a good man, Dor, and a friend to me. I was deeply saddened by his death."
"He said, in his journal, he said I should come to you. He said I could trust you."
"I only hope that I can be worthy of that trust."
The angel sipped its wine. London below is the second city that I have cared for. The first sank beneath the waves, and there was nothing I could do to prevent it. I know what pain is, and loss. You have my sympathies. What would you like to know? Dor paused. My family. They were killed by Krupp and Vandemar, but who ordered it? I want to know why. The angel nodded. Many secrets find their way down to me, it said. Many rumors and half-truths and echoes. Then it turned to Richard. And you? What do you want, Richard Mayhew? Richard shrugged. I want my life back, and my flat, and my job. That can happen, said the angel. Yeah, right, said Richard flatly. Do you doubt me, Richard Mayhew? Asked the angel Islington. Richard looked into its eyes. They were a luminescent grey in colour, eyes as old as the universe, eyes that had seen galaxies congeal from stardust 10 million years ago. And Richard shook his head. Islington smiled at him, kindly. Will not be easy, and you and your companions will face some very real difficulties, both in the task and in the return. But there could be a way that we can learn, a key to all our problems. It got up and walked over to a small rock shelf, where it picked up a figurine, one of several on the shelf. It was a small black statuette, depicting some kind of animal made of volcanic glass. The angel handed it to Dor. This will bring you safely through the last stage of your journey back to me, it said. The rest is up to you. What do you want us to do? Asked Richard. The Black Friars are custodians of a key, it said. Bring it to me. And you can use it to find out who killed my family? Asked Dor. I hope so, said the angel. Richard finished his glass of wine. He felt it warming him, running through him. He had the strange feeling that if he looked down at his fingers, he would be able to see the wine glowing through them, as if he were made of light. Good luck, whispered the angel Islington. There was a rushing sound, like a wind soughing across a lost forest, or the beating of mighty wings. Richard and Dor were sitting on the floor, in a room in the British Museum, staring up at a carved painting of an angel on a cathedral door. The room was dark and empty. The party had been over for a long time. The sky outside was beginning to lighten. Richard stood up, then leaned down and helped Dor up. Black Friars, he asked. Dor nodded. Richard had crossed Black Friars Bridge in the City of London many times, and he had often passed through Black Friars Station. But he was learning by now not to assume anything. Place or people? He asked. People. Richard walked over to the Angelus. He ran a finger down its painted robe. Do you think he can really do it? Get me my life back? I've never heard of such a thing. But I don't think he would have lied to us. He is an angel. Dor opened her hand, looked at the statue of the beast. My father had one of these, she said, sadly. She put it deep in one of the pockets of her brown leather jacket. Well, said Richard, we're not going to get the key back lollygagging around here, are we? They walked through the empty museum corridors. So what do you know about this key, then? Asked Richard. Nothing, said Dor.
They had reached the main doors of the museum.
I've heard of the Blackfriars, but I've never actually had anything to do with them.
She pressed her fingers against a seriously locked glass door, which swung open at her touch.
A bunch of monks, said Richard, thoughtfully. I bet if we just tell them it's for an angel, a real one, they'll give us the sacred key and throw in the magic tin opener and the amazing whistling corkscrew as a surprise bonus.
He began to laugh. He wondered if the wine was still affecting him.
You're in good spirits, said Dor.
He nodded enthusiastically.
I'm going to go home. Everything is going to be normal again. Boring again. Wonderful again.
Richard looked at the stone steps that lead up to the British Museum and decided that they were made to be danced down by Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and seeing that neither of them happened to be available, he began to dance down the steps, doing what he fondly imagined was an amazing Fred Astaire impersonation, while humming something approximately halfway between Puttin' on the Ritz and Top Hat, White Tie and Tails.
Yat-ta-da, yat-ta-da, tat-ta-da-ya,
he sang, soft-shoeing down the steps and up again. Dor stood at the top of the steps, staring at him in horror. Then she began to giggle, helplessly. He looked up at her and doffed his imaginary white silk top hat to her, mind tossing it high in the air, catching it and putting it back on his head. Twit, said Dor, and smiled at him. In response, Richard grabbed her hand and continued dancing up and down the steps. Dor hesitated for a moment, then she, too, began to dance. She danced much better than Richard did. At the bottom of the steps, they tumbled, breathless and exhausted and giggling, into each other's arms. Richard felt his world spin. He felt her heart beating against his chest. The moment began to transmute, and he wondered if there was something he should do. He wondered if he should kiss her. He wondered if he wanted to kiss her, and he realized that he truly did not know. He looked into her opal-colored eyes. Dor put her head on one side and pulled free. She pulled up the collar on her brown leather jacket, pulled it around her, armor and protection.
Let's go and find our bodyguard, said Dor.
And they walked away together down the sidewalk towards British Museum Station, stumbling only a little from time to time.
What, asked Mr. Croup, do you want?
What, asked the Marquis de Carabas, a little more rhetorically, does anyone want?
Dead things, suggested Mr. Vandemar. Extra teeth.
I thought perhaps we could make a deal, said the Marquis.
Mr. Croup began to laugh. It sounded like a piece of blackboard being dragged over the nails of a wall of severed fingers.
Oh, Monsieur Marquis, I think I can confidently state, with no risk of contradiction from any parties here present, that you have taken leave of whatever senses you are reputed to have had. You are,
he confided, if you will permit the vulgarism, completely off your head.
Say the word, said Mr. Vandemar,
who was now standing behind the Marquis's chair,
and it'll be off his neck before you can say Jack Ketch.
The Marquis breathed heavily on his fingernails and polished them on the lapel of his coat.
I have always felt, he said, that violence was the last refuge of the incompetent, and empty threats the final sanctuary of the terminally inept.
Mr. Croup glared.
What are you doing here?
He hissed. The Marquis de Carabas stretched like a big cat, a lynx perhaps, or a huge black panther,
and at the end of the stretch he was standing up, with his hands thrust deep in the pockets of his magnificent coat.
"You are," he said idly and conversationally,
"I understand, Mr. Croup,
a collector of Tang Dynasty figurines."
"How did you know that?"
"People tell me things. I'm approachable." The Marquis's smile was pure, untroubled, guileless, the smile of a man selling you a used Bible.
"Even if I were," began Mr. Croup.
"If you were," said the Marquis de Carabas, "you might be interested in this." He took one hand out of his pocket and displayed it to Mr. Croup. Until earlier that evening, it had sat in a glass case in the vaults of one of London's leading merchant banks. It was listed in certain catalogues as the Spirit of Autumn, grave figure. It was roughly 8 inches high, a piece of glazed pottery that had been shaped and painted and fired while Europe was in the Dark Ages, 600 years before Columbus's first voyage. Mr. Croup hissed involuntarily and reached for it. The Marquis pulled it out of reach, cradled it to his chest.
"No, no," said the Marquis. "It's not as simple as that."
"No?" asked Mr. Croup. "But what's to stop us taking it and leaving bits of you all over the underside? We've never dismembered a Marquis before."
"Have," said Mr. Vandemar. "In York, in the 14th century, in the rain."
"He wasn't a Marquis," said Mr. Croup. "He was the Earl of Exeter."
"And Marquis of Westmoreland?" Mr. Vandemar looked rather pleased with himself. Mr. Croup sniffed.
"What's to stop us hacking you into as many pieces as we hacked the Marquis of Westmoreland?" he asked.
De Carabas took his other hand out of his pocket. It held a small hammer. He tossed the hammer in the air like a barman in a movie about cocktail making and caught it by the handle, ending with the hammer poised over the china figurine.
"Oh, please," he said, "no more silly threats. I think I'd feel better if you were both standing back over there."
Mr. Vandemar shot a look at Mr. Croup, who nodded almost imperceptibly. There was a tremble in the air, and Mr. Vandemar was standing beside Mr. Croup, who smiled like a skull.
"I have indeed been known to purchase the occasional Tang piece," he admitted. "Is that for sale?"
"We don't go in so much for buying and selling here in the underside, Mr. Croup. Barter, exchange, that's what we look for. But yes, indeed, this desirable little piece is certainly up for grabs."
Mr. Croup pursed his lips. He folded his arms. He unfolded them. He ran one hand through his greasy hair. Then,
"Name your price," said Mr. Croup.
The Marquis let himself breathe a deep, relieved and almost audible sigh. It was possible that he was going to be able to pull this whole grandiose ruse off after all.
"First, 3 answers to 3 questions, he said.
Croup nodded.
"Each way, we get 3 answers too.
"Fair enough," said the Marquis. "Secondly, I get safe conduct out of here, and you agree to give me at least an hour's head start."
Croup nodded violently.
"Agreed. Ask your first question."
His gaze was fixed on the statue.
"First question, who are you working for?"
"Oh, that's an easy one," said Mr. Croup. "That's a simple answer. We are working for our employer, who wishes to remain nameless."
"Huh,"
Why did you kill Dawes' family? Orders from our employer, said Mr. Croup, his smile becoming more foxy by the moment.
Why didn't you kill Dawe when you had a chance?
Before Mr. Croup could answer, Mr. Vandermeer said, Got to keep her alive. She's the only one that can open the door. Mr. Croup glared up at his associate.
That's it, he said. Tell him everything, why don't you?
I wanted a turn, muttered Mr. Vandermeer.
Right, said Mr. Croup. So you've got three answers for all the good that will do you. My first question, why are you protecting her?
Her father saved my life, said the Marquis, honestly. I never paid off my debt to him. I prefer debts to be in my favour.
I've got a question.
As have I, Mr. Vandermeer. The upworlder, Richard Mayhew, why is he travelling with her? Why does she permit it?
Sentimentality on her part, said the Marquis de Carabas. He wondered, as he said it, if that was the whole truth. He had begun to wonder whether there might perhaps be more to the upworlder than met the eye.
Now me, said Mr. Vandermeer, what number am I thinking of?
I beg your pardon?
What number am I thinking of? Repeated Mr. Vandermeer. It's between one and a lot, he added helpfully.
Seven, said the Marquis. Mr. Vandermeer nodded, impressed. Mr. Croup began, Where is the... But the Marquis shook his head.
Uh-uh, he said. Now we're getting greedy.
There was a moment of utter silence in that dank cellar. Then once more water dripped and maggots rustled, and the Marquis said, An hour's head start, remember?
Of course, said Mr. Croup.
The Marquis de Carabas tossed the figurine to Mr. Croup, who caught it eagerly, like an addict catching a plastic baggie filled with white powder of dubious legality. And then, without a backward glance, the Marquis left the cellar. Mr. Croup examined the figurine minutely, turning it over and over in his hands, a Dickensian curator of the Museum of the Damned contemplating a prize exhibit. His tongue flicked out from time to time like a snake's. A perceptible flush appeared on his pallid cheeks.
Oh, fine, fine, he whispered. Tang Dynasty, indeed, 1,200 years old. The finest pottery figurines ever made on this earth. This was created by Kai Lung, finest of potters. There is not a twin to it in existence. Examine the colour of the glaze, the sense of proportion, the life.
He was smiling now, like a baby. The innocent smile looked lost and confused on the shady terrain of Mr. Croup's face.
It adds a little wonder and beauty to the world.
And then he grinned. Too widely, and lowered his face to the figurine and crushed its head in his teeth, chomping and chewing wildly, swallowing in lumps. His teeth ground the china to a fine powder, which dusted the lower part of his face. He gloried in its destruction, throwing himself into it with the strange madness and uncontrolled bloodlust of a fox in a henhouse. And then, when the statue was nothing but dust, he turned to Mr. Vandermeer. He seemed strangely mellow, almost languid.
How long did we say we'd give him?
An hour.
And how long has it been?
6 minutes.
Mr. Croup lowered his head. He ran a finger across his chin, licked the powdered clay from his fingertip.
You follow him, Mr. Vandermeer, said Mr. Croup. I need a little more time in which to savour the occasion.
Hunter could hear them walking down the steps. She was standing in the shadows, with her arms folded, in the same position she had been when they left her. Richard was humming, loudly. Dor was giggling, helplessly. Then she would stop.